on this episode of Risky Business.
There's a lot more pressure because there are new regulations coming online around the world, seems like almost daily. And in the U.S., every state seems to be rolling out a slightly different set of regulations. So keeping up with that for all businesses, I'm sure, is a tremendous challenge.
I'm Steve Muddyman, and this is Risky Business, a show from GAN Integrity covering the wide range of issues in compliance and ethics, but with one goal in mind, empowering your people to do the right thing. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the highly anticipated Season 3 premiere of Risky Business. I'm your host, Steve Muddyman, and it's an absolute pleasure to have you with us today. To kick off the season, we're diving even deeper into the world of ethics and compliance and the ever-evolving landscape of business practices. In this episode, we've got a true trailblazer in the realm of ethics and compliance, David Mills, Director of Global Ethics, Business Integrity, and Security at Bunge. During our conversation, we'll explore the fundamental importance of upholding high standards in today's business environment and dissect the profound impact of ethics on brand integrity. We'll also peel back the layers on how companies are tackling the demands of regulatory compliance and the intriguing challenges they face. With that, here's David. Hi, Dave. How are you today?
Good, Steve. How are you?
I'm very well. I know we're speaking to each other on very different time zones. It's your morning, my sort of early evening. How's your day so far?
So far, so good. Beautiful weather here in my part of the world, so I'm anxious to finish up and get outside.
So why don't you tell everyone where you are?
I am in St. Louis, Missouri. And by no coincidence, if you're looking on video, I happen to put on a St. Louis Cardinals shirt for no particular reasons.
I doubt that's a coincidence. And actually, you've got a nice array of hats behind you, which maybe we'll get into in a minute. So tell us about you and your journey at Bunge, and then we'll talk about the company itself.
Yeah, sure. So it's probably important to understand the entire background of somebody in a role like this, I think. So I spent a good number of years in law enforcement as a criminal investigator, jumped out of that in about 2000, went to a large global aerospace company. I spent 15 years and helped build really a state-of-the-art ethics compliance program. And then the opportunity came up about 8 years ago to go to Bunge, which is a large food and ingredient manufacturer and a global commodities trader, and start all over again and help build a program there. And 8 years later, I am still here and loving it.
Incredible. And so tell us about Bunge. I of course know quite a lot about the company because we've spoken before, but for those that don't know what Bunge does, fundamental part of the food chain, aren't you? Give a sense of the size of the organization, the operations. What does the business do? What does it produce? And how does it serve the needs of individuals like us and those that would be listening to this podcast?
One of the fundamental mottos is we do everything from farm to table. So like I mentioned, we're a huge commodities trader, which means the company buys raw grains in the form of corn and soybeans and rapeseed, which is what canola oil comes from. And then some of the more exotic ones, such as shea and palm, and even a few others, sunflower, and probably a few others that I've forgotten. About 70% of the portfolio is actually processing all of those grains and developing various products that winds up in your food. You probably eat something every day that has a Bunge product in it. The other 30% is we truly trade and move the raw materials all around the world. We operate in 45 different countries right now. And if you've kept up with the news lately, we're merging with a company called Viterra based out of the Netherlands, which will make us 60% larger than we are today. So lots of stuff going on in the Bunge world.
And with regard to these, you know, we get into this and the implications of being able to effectively trade in 45 countries around the world. And of course, with, you know, the news that you just described there, that clearly that's going to get bigger, one assumes. That's obviously puts a huge amount of pressures on your organization, which we're going to talk about in a moment. And, you know, the realization of what it takes to ensure that the organization is able to be compliant in terms of how it trades, you know, with regulatory, you know, demands that are placed on, you know, businesses wherever you are trading from the world. But before we get to that, you know, because people may not necessarily know too much about that, the world that you serve, maybe a good place to sort of help to ground how the company works and how it operates is perhaps to talk about the culture at Bunge. How would you describe the culture that's there, and maybe there's been a change over time from something in the past to where it is today. Could you just talk about, how the culture plays out in the business?
Well, obviously, it's quite diverse, as you might expect. If we operate in so many countries, you're going to have a diverse overall culture. Fundamentally speaking, I would describe it as a down-to-earth sort of informal culture, mainly because farmers are the basis of our business. If we don't have the farmers, we don't have a company. So we tend to be connected to them. So maybe we tend to absorb some of the farming culture. In fact, we refer to them as customers. So sometimes it's kind of confusing. More specifically, with that diverse workforce, and especially if you're in the office settings, we've routinely move employees around the world. So if you go into any of the larger offices that we have, it's truly a diverse cultural experience, and they've all learned to respect the other cultures that are around them. And I truly believe it does create a competitive advantage. We have three core values within the company. One is do what's right, act as one team, and drive for excellence. And really, in two of the three of those, the ethics and compliance culture is built right in, more so in do what's right than anything, but it's really kind of present in all three of those. And it's probably worth pointing out, specifically from the ethics standpoint and ethical culture, it's important, I think, to measure culture. So in the last 4 years, we've done two ethical culture surveys, and we've had, in both instances, nearly half the company participate, which for any internal survey, that's really, really quite high. And I didn't mention earlier, we've got 25 to 30,000 employees right now around the globe. Of course, that varies from day to day. When you get half of a team that size participating in a survey, you've done something right. And of that, nearly half of the participants were from the industrial section, so the people that work in all of our facilities and make all the products, and typically they tend to participate less than the office staff, so to speak. So that was really a big win for us. But most importantly, amongst the seven largest or the seven key components within that survey, we beat the benchmark by 2 or 3 points in every one of them over the last two surveys. So for example, the overall favorable benchmark globally is 84% for this last survey. Ours was favorable at 87%. And all of the seven main components reflected that exact same favorable rating. So we really saw that as a big win and really indicated for us that we really have a strong ethics culture and compliance culture.
And that's a great point to pick up on. Firstly, congratulations on the degree of engagement. As you say, when you've got an organization which fluctuates, I suspect, to the degrees that you described there, but when you're talking about up to 30,000 employees, that's a huge level of participation. And you talked about that basis, the base there, when you mentioned about ethics within the organization. And of course, that plays out in your function and job title too, of course. But the idea that culture is everyone's business, isn't it? It's not just the domain of you, your team, or HR, or somewhere else. And this is maybe a difficult question to answer, but I'll ask it anyway and see if we can go at that. How do you embody that key, for me, that key value that you said just now, which is do what is right? How do you get the organization to embrace and recognize what is right when you think about those diverse cultures that you talked about just now? Because what is right for one person versus what is right for someone else, wherever they may be in quite different parts of the world, obviously can be down to interpret. How do you manage that? How does that sort of all come to play?
Yeah, so as you pointed out, what is right or ethical to you might not be the same for me. And when you're dealing with, I'll say we have maybe 20 different cultures within the company, everything from US to China to Argentina to Ukraine, they all have a different baseline for what they consider right or ethical. Hopefully there are some commonalities amongst all those. But our organization, one of our responsibilities is to drive throughout the company what the company believes is appropriate business behavior, or to put it in the terms of our value, drive to the company what we believe is doing what's right for the company. So I'm sure we'll get into it at some point here, but that's one of our responsibilities to do that. And of course, there's a whole host of activities that it really takes to drive that, and keeping it sustainable is probably the hardest part of that piece.
So should we talk about the scope of the team that you're part of? Let's talk about where these people are, the responsibilities of the team. I'm sure, the audience will want to hear about, size of the team, because that often is an indicator of scale, skill sets, etc. Could you take us through, you know, the makeup of the organization?
Sure. So the compliance team as a whole, which within our company is Global Ethics and Compliance, has about 30 team members all together. And it's really across four primary functions and then a few individuals that are like standalone attorneys that have specific cutouts. And as you mentioned earlier, I own the Global Ethics and Business Integrity function. I should say I lead that function. I don't own it. I lead the GEI function, as we call it. And I have about half of those team members, of those 30 that are on my team. And I guess we probably are responsible for about 80% of the ethics compliance activities within the organization. As I mentioned, the company's in roughly 45 different countries, but we've got our staff in perhaps 15 to 20 of those countries. My specific function, I have a team in Europe and Asia, South America, and the United States. And it's important to point out, every ethics compliance team and every company seems to be different and has a slightly different set of responsibilities. For example, ethics compliance within our company is responsible for sanctions compliance and data privacy compliance. And a lot of companies, those two items are under a different section.
Did you say sanctions and data privacy?
Correct.
Yeah. You mentioned data privacy as well. Let's spend a moment talking about that in terms of your areas of focus. Can you give people a degree of the scale of what we're describing here when we talk about data privacy and your specific role in that?
I can't some, because I'm not specifically responsible for data privacy. One of my peers has that, and he's had his hands full trying to make it a more robust program. When you're in a company this size, you're always running into some level of bureaucracy and a few roadblocks here or there, but he's done a tremendous job really improving and enhancing the whole data privacy program. I do know there's a lot more pressure because there are new regulations coming online around the world, seems like almost daily. And in the U.S., every state seems to be rolling out a slightly different set of regulations. So keeping up with that for all businesses, I'm sure, is a tremendous challenge. So for my ethics compliance organization, it's certainly been a priority and a challenge.
When you think about, and you and I have spoken in the past about this, where we've talked about ethics and compliance isn't, we said earlier that ethics is, you know, ultimately everybody's business, and the ability to uphold the highest levels of standards to do what is right clearly is a core tenet of the culture at Bungie. But when we think about that now in terms of the impact across the business, can we talk about how that impacts, you know, the much more strategic aspects of the way in which the business is run? And perhaps you could give us some insight as to how what you're doing, what the team is doing, some of the things that you've described just now, making it into the strategic direction in terms of the way in which the company is setting out its stall, the impact on brand integrity, if you like, and how senior leadership view what's going on here within your function and its impact not just on culture, but on the standing of the company overall.
Probably a number of answers to that. But
yes,
of course, driving the company's strategy or being aligned with and supporting the company's strategy is priority one, of course. So we've got our own internal strategies that roll up to the corporate strategies. But all of the activities that we're involved in to support that. Well, first, I'll go through the list of probably just the typical activities that most ethics compliance organizations do. Responsible for driving and encouraging tone at the top. So we're having conversations with the executive leaders and some of the key steering committees all the time. And that's always a topic of conversation. Our team is responsible for a whole host of recurring trainings, everything from code of conduct training to anti-corruption, antitrust, and a whole handful of others. We're responsible for a good portion of the internal investigations. In fact, that's probably, depending on what region we're working in, that's probably between 60 and 80% of our entire portfolio is the investigative piece. We manage 9 different policies, and we're the subject matter expert on those policies. We're responsible for reviewing, you know, all incoming and outgoing gifts and approving or denying whether those are acceptable. We conduct several yearly risk assessments. Of course, there's ongoing consultations with the business. Awareness is a big piece of a program like this, I think. So we're publishing at least one story a month on a compliance topic or on a real world case that happened within the company to drive the awareness. And I mentioned the culture surveys that we do, which I think is important to be able to measure just where your culture is going. So those are all the basic things that we do. But more recently, since travel restrictions have relaxed, we've really been involved in an ongoing grassroots effort to get personally involved in the businesses. So when a training delivery is needed, we will do our best to do that in person rather than using the online on-demand platform. We get invited to join meetings all the time for ethics compliance consultations. So we will do that in person as best we can. And really the staff is just getting directly involved with a wide variety of employees that we probably might not have done 3 or 4 years ago. And I think we've seen good gains from that. The amount of referrals that we get, the amount of requests for consultations that we get, just seem to be on the uprise. And that's what we're looking for. That's a good indicator that we're integrating the ethics and compliance culture into the business. We promote the three core values in all of these meetings that we're attending. So that grassroots effort's really been pretty important to us, and we're seeing the fruits of that labor, I think.
You make a hugely important point, which I have, you know, wanted to talk to you about. When we talk about business strategy, we often think that's the domain of the C-suite or senior leadership in functions across the organization. But we all know, don't we? It's not just about those as stakeholders. And you talked about customers, which we'll maybe come to in a moment, and how they play a role in this. But, you know, employees on the ground, when you've got a size of organization that we talked about earlier, getting that degree of engagement, that participation, that ability to be involved, if you will, that's a full-time task, isn't it? You know, it can't be all push from your organization. You need pull as well, don't you? So those sorts of initiatives that you described there to get individuals involved so they feel that they're part of it, sounds like it's a crucial part of what you do.
It is. In fact, one piece I forgot to mention is we just launched a pilot program using ethics ambassadors. I know some companies, I've got some peers that have ambassador teams that are 120 to 200 strong, and they have a whole team that does nothing but manage the ambassadors. I don't know that I need a program that size necessarily, but we've launched a much smaller one and with six ambassadors and two different locations to help drive that grassroots interaction with the organizations. And we picked key locations where we felt like the engagement was not nearly what it should be, considering what the employee population is. That's just an indication of our commitment to sort of driving that level of engagement. Fortunately for us, or for this company, strong engagement really has never been a problem. It's always been either at the global benchmarks for engagement or higher. But the challenge is to either sustain that or improve on it. We're always looking for continuous improvement. I don't know, you ever reach 100%, obviously, but you can always go from 87 to 88 to 89 the next year and get it where it can be.
And so we talked about employees, we talked about other parts of the organization. Maybe we'll come to some of those in a moment. How about senior leadership? Degrees of engagement or how do the things that you're dealing with, some of the issues that you talked about, tone at the top, you know, you mentioned that earlier, training and the impact and the outcomes of, you know, how that training on ABAC and code of conduct that you mentioned just now. You talked about some things relating to gifts and maybe entertainment there as well. How does what you capture, what you report on, how does that surface back up the organization and give someone a sense of frequency, degrees of insight that you provide to leadership, if you can, Dave?
Sure. So we do a couple of different things. Of course, we report to the audit committee on a quarterly basis. You know, that information rarely leaves the audit committee, so that shouldn't ever be the sole source of reporting your organization's metrics and the status of your culture to management. So then, of course, the executive leadership team gets regular updates either from myself or the chief compliance officer, but probably most importantly for the business as a whole, and within each region, at least twice a year, we do a very detailed update for all of the regional business leaders. And we really refer to value chain business leaders, not so much by region. And that might be a group of up to 100 company leaders. It's very detailed, everything from all the standard metrics you might see from, you know, number of cases, substantiation rates, a number through the hotline, how many anonymous complaints versus not anonymous. And we always compare all of those to what the global current benchmarks are. But then we get into the number of conflicts of interest declared and key investigations that happened during the period. It gets quite detailed. It's quite a lengthy presentation, and I've got one or two people dedicated to really managing all that. Then, of course, when you do that, you have to end it with what this all means for the business, what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, keep doing this, try to get your people to stop doing this. But most importantly, go back to your teams and share everything I just told you so everybody knows what's going on. Along with those presentations, we always publish an article on our portal that shares a high-level summary of all that same information. And quite often, it's one of the most read stories that gets put out there. People really find it of interest, but it keeps the message in front of them. So that's how we keep the business informed on what's really going on.
Fascinating. And I think, you know, 100 people, you know, 100 business leaders from obviously pretty diverse parts of the organization. Many of those business leaders, I assume, and let's talk about that, you know, are engaged with third parties outside the business, right? You know, so you've talked a lot about how those internal ethics and compliance related issues, you know, are affecting, you know, individuals within the business. And of course, you know, we talk about stakeholders in the broader context. You talked about farmers as customers, but there's also a whole bunch of third parties that are outside your organization that provide services to you, and you provide services with them. How do you engage them in these kinds of principles that sit at the heart of the values that you uphold within the business? Because we all interact, don't we, with third parties outside the business. And, you know, we come back to that point we made earlier about, well, what is doing the right thing, you know, right. And how do you engage those third parties in, you know, some of these core elements that you described in the program?
So that's an interesting question, because in that particular area, the world seems to be changing at a fairly rapid pace. Our customers, especially our large customers, are really, you know, demanding a lot more from the business in terms of ethics, compliance, sustainability, human rights than ever before, to the point that some of their supplier codes of conduct are really getting, you know, quite lengthy and detailed and prescriptive. And if you're a really large customer, you've got the leverage to say, this is what you're going to do, or we're not doing business necessarily. Landscape is changing significantly, sort of along the same lines. I mean, we're really doing the same. We're really enhancing the code of conduct and developing a more specific code of conduct related to the supply chain and pushing that out to suppliers all around the world. In this business, that's specifically a challenge, because a lot of your key suppliers, as I mentioned at the beginning, are farmers. They're often individuals that spend their days working alone in a field. And to look at a company's supplier code of conduct and say with confidence, yes, I can absolutely follow this code of conduct, that's somewhat foreign to a lot of the farming community. It's becoming more common for sure, but getting that message to them, helping them understand really what it means, is a challenge. But that landscape is changing, seems like almost daily, with every third party that we engage with. So we're right in the middle of all kinds of work in that area. And I'm working closely with our sustainability group, and one of my partners on a project is our director of human rights, and it's all commingled and really quite a challenge to respond to the customers and then make sure we're doing the right thing by our suppliers.
You touch on a fascinating point. I had some questions I wanted to sort of put to you about that. You know, you hit the nail on the head there, where, you know, you're talking about the mood of how the world is today. All businesses are trying to uphold the highest levels of standards, of course, and they expect that of the partners that they work with, don't they? Which I think is what you're describing here. I mean, does that, when you talked about the director of human rights there, we talk about sustainability, we talk about the environmental impact of the way in which the business operates and how it operates in and around, you know, different jurisdictions around the world. Is this changing the landscape and these demands that, you know, perhaps these not only what you're placing into the hands of these third parties and asking them to describe how they operate, perhaps going through a process of screening how they operate and getting them to continually be able to update that information? I mean, that's coming back the other way in terms of how they want to or need to be working with you too. Is that changing because of these dynamics now? You know, we talked about modern slavery just now. I think you touched on that too. All of these dynamics actually start to stretch stretch the bandwidth, surely, of your team and the skill sets of the team to be able to deal with this. How are you overcoming that?
Well, it certainly creates more of a resource drain. The simple answer is most companies wind up charging more for a product because they do have to take into account all of these areas of compliance that are new and really have become not optional, but a must be for their business. Going back just 2 years ago, we didn't have a dedicated human rights director. Going back, I'll say 10 years ago, we probably didn't have a dedicated sustainability team, but we have all of that now. And it ultimately gets paid for by the consumers somewhere. But just like any business, growing those organizations, you've got to be able to show the value proposition. You've got to be able to figure out how you're going to budget for that. And is it possible to ultimately be competitive while paying for these programs? I guess at the end of the day, all companies are having to do it for the most part. So we certainly remain competitive because they're probably doing the same thing we are. I guess the question is, can we do it more efficiently than they do or more effectively?
And that I was going to come to exactly that. As you and I, as consumers of everything, it doesn't take me to remind people how the cost of living has just skyrocketed. We all feel it, don't we? And you describe characteristics of what's happening in the supply chain that does impact that. You know, a lot of people don't necessarily think about those implications in terms of costs passed on through the supply chain. Often think more of the raw material itself, perhaps, and maybe the cost of the supply chain, as opposed to, you know, understanding how the supply chain is really operating in the example that you gave.
But, you know, it does seem, you know, all of this is consumer driven, right? We wouldn't be making these changes if the consumer wasn't demanding that we're more sustainable and that we are really making sure our suppliers are not engaged in modern slavery and all the other areas under human rights. It seems to me, and I haven't studied this in any depth, but it seems to me that the average consumer is willing to accept that there's going to be some cost involved with knowing that they're buying whatever their product is, a reputable company that's not doing business in the wrong way.
And I think, and of course, what you're offering is choice, isn't it? You know, you're offering that choice for the individual to make that personal decision as to what they want to buy, I guess. You mentioned about remaining competitive and ensuring you're competitive. I mean, let's get into, you know, some of the areas that relate to, you know, how you go about doing that. You know, the old adage of having the right people working, you know, the right process with the right technology to drive efficiencies, improve productivity. I mean, do you want to talk about, you know, how you're using technology to help to ensure that, you know, in the areas that you have responsibility for, enable you guys to, you know, continue to remain competitive?
Well, yeah, that's kind of the question, right? How do you support your business and remain competitive? There's, I suppose, any number of answers to that, but you really have to have an effective program. And how do you do that? It's tough because there's so many components to a typical compliance program. And as I mentioned earlier, not all programs are the same. Some have some special areas built into them, like ours does, that are kind of unusual. But I think you have to start with the foundation, which is the proper policies and processes to build the fundamentals of ethics and compliance. Of course, it's not enough just to have those. You know, they've got to be pushed into all of the internal company processes. And as we mentioned earlier, it's got to be part of the culture and it's got to be part of the everyday life of the company. And of course, how do you really build it into and integrate it into how the company operates? Well, there's really any number of possible touch points where you actually can physically build it in. I think one good example is probably, to use one of our recent examples, third-party due diligence or supplier due diligence. They have an existing process to onboard, you know, suppliers. So we built into that process a number of checkpoints to determine if they are really in scope for more robust due diligence. And it could be risk of corrupt activity or bribery or a few other key areas. So we've literally built into that process the checkpoints and the gates that they can't get past until it's been determined whether or not they're in scope and that piece of diligence is done. So that's just one example where we've built in the compliance requirement directly into a company procedure. I can probably name 100 others. And then even those that are outside of our organization, such as what our internal credit organization does. They have a very similar process when it comes to onboarding or providing credit to a customer. One of my peer organizations in ethics and compliance is responsible for the know your customer piece. So a lot of those compliance checkpoints are built into that onboarding process. And we won't do business with a customer if they don't pass that test. So to have an effective compliance program, not only do you need to do all the things that I said my team does earlier, but you really need to physically build it into how your company does business.
And you talked about a lot of things there, which is fascinating. I mean, at the heart of all of this is lots of data, isn't it? Being able to connect the dots with that data as to what you're picking up when you go through a process of enhanced due diligence, which you sort of alluded to there, you know, screening process. You think about, you know, potential conflicts with regard to, you know, the accepting of gifts and things as you interact with those third parties. You talked about internal credit. Earlier we spoke about data privacy. You know, we talked about KYC and know your customer. I mean, there's a lot going on here in terms of being able to connect the dots in terms of what is that data telling you. And it's not just a one-off process. You alluded earlier to, you know, the continual, you know, requirement to ensure that this is an active, ongoing process with third parties or suppliers. It's not just once a year. I mean,
and that's really all just the business process piece. You know, there's a whole another world of the human piece and the employee piece and the staff and keeping ethics compliance as a part of their daily lives. They may have to follow a process, but that doesn't mean they are consciously taking steps to make the right decisions. So there's a whole nother aspect to helping push it into the business.
You sound like you enjoy your job, Dave.
I do. It could be just because I've done it a long time. I don't know anything else anymore. But I do. I have a passion for it, and I have for quite some time.
There's a lot of people involved here in this, and you know, the points that you made with regard to trying to make this not just your function or your team or your peers' team's responsibility. Everyone needs to be part of this thing, right? You know, there's a lot of takeaways here, but you know, getting the culture right, getting the people mentally and emotionally engaged in this seems to be a core component of how you've been successful, you know, across a 30,000 wide employee, you know, organization. All in all, I mean, great conversation. Really enjoyed the discussion. Team sound motivated, which is great to hear. I love the conversation we talked about with regard to, you know, the sustainability team, the director of human rights. We talked about some of those other massive issues, which are, you know, top of mind for not just for businesses, but for individuals and the people that want to come and work at organizations like Bunge, you know, and how they determine the choices they make, you know, in terms of where they choose to work and spend, you know, a significant chunk of their time, and the way in which, you know, what you've described as a culture that fits what the corporation stands for. I mean, I took a look at, you know, some of your social feeds, you know, earlier in the week before we, you know, came to this conversation, and there's certainly, you know, a very energetic workforce from what I can see.
It is.
You know, very active in promoting all that is good about what the company stands for.
Yes, it is. I truly love the company, love the people here and my specific team, of course. Not everybody can say that about their employer. But everything you said is spot on, and it's you know, been an exciting couple of years for this organization, and it's going to be an exciting couple of years going forward too. So I'm pretty excited to see where it goes.
And Dave, it would be remiss of me, for those that will see you on video, they're clearly going to want to know what those hats are that are behind you. So you could you give us a quick rundown of which is which there?
Sure. It's a very, very short collection. I obviously didn't work for the NYPD, but I have many friends that did. The second one is a law enforcement agency I worked for 15 years. And then I did some special assignments with the Social Security Administration, and that's their hat. So I've got all kinds of collections around me that you can't see on camera, but those happen to be the ones that sit behind the desk.
They're the ones I saw as soon as you and I joined the call earlier. So, look, it's been an absolute pleasure, as always, to have the conversation, specifically to have you, you know, join us on Risky Business. Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I'll let you go and enjoy the rest of your day. You're several hours behind me, so I'll let you go and enjoy the rest of your day and that great weather you described at the top of the conversation.
I will try my best, Steve.
Thanks for listening to Risky Business. For more insights and resources, check out the show notes or go to ganintegrity.com. And be sure to follow along wherever you get your audio.